like to say, but let's make sure the attorneys are able to hear me and that we can hear them. Ms. Moreau, are you able to hear everything I'm saying?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, and I can hear you clearly. Mr. Marcelak?
I can hear you, Your Honor.
Great. So before we call the case, I want to make sure a couple of things. One, if you are not speaking, please mute yourself. We have allowed only the attorneys to speak and share their screens, and other folks may observe, but they're not able to participate in that way. Also, if you keep your eye on the clock, sometimes it gets very small. So if you're not in the right view on Zoom, you may not be able to see how much time is remaining, and we tell folks to toggle that so that they're in the gallery view, not the active speaker view, and then you should be able to see it a little bit bigger. We also understand that from time to time there may be interruptions, pets, doorbells, et cetera, technical problems. If there isn't an issue, we'll do our best to accommodate whatever it is that's happening. If you give us a heads up, we'll stop the proceedings and make sure that you have all the time to which you're entitled to make your argument. And last, we are making an audio recording of this, so state your name before you begin and the party that you represent, and there are no other recordings that are permitted. And with that, why don't we go ahead and call the case?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bryan, Judge Cochran, Judge Gaitas, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. Calling case A21-1351, City of Lakeville versus Department of Public Safety.
And Ms. Moreau, as the attorney for Relator, are you prepared to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, this is Jennifer Moreau, attorney for the City of Lakeville, the appellant in this matter. This matter is about the proper interpretation and application of Minnesota Statute 171.12, Subdivision 1A, which requires the Department of Public Safety to immediately and permanently revoke the authorization to access drivers and vehicle services, the DBS data, of anyone who willfully accesses such data in violation of state or federal law. In this matter, the Department of Public Safety, or DPS, the respondent here, revoked the DBS access of a City of Lakeville employee, I'll refer to her as Ms. Davis or Davis today, after she accessed her own driver's license record. She was trying to run a background check for an applicant for city employment, but she was having trouble accessing this applicant's driver's license records. It took her about 12 tries before she was successful. She then searched for her own name to verify that she was using the correct format and searching for a name because there was no test records available to search through the DBS system. Based upon that search and access of her own name, the DPS decided and issued a decision after doing an audit into the situation that Ms. Davis accessed her own record without a lawful business purpose and therefore permanently and immediately revoked her access and also referred her to criminal prosecution based upon this. No further explanation or reasoning was provided, nor was there anything in the decision that indicated a finding that she acted willfully in violation of law. And in fact, in the decision,
Ms. Moreau, I just want to stop you at the beginning here to ask a few questions about what we're looking at in terms of a record. You know, this is an unusual case in that there was no hearing or anything like that. And we do have the letter that was sent to the employee in the employer. We have a series of emails going back and forth. I guess my first question is, are we to consider the series of emails going back and forth as part of the record in this case? And, how much weight should we place on that portion of the record if you agree that it is part of the record?
And that's a good question, Your Honor. And in my understanding and how this procedure works, because as you mentioned, this is an unusual procedure. We didn't have a contested hearing in front of a neutral arbiter. And in this matter, I do believe that the record that the Attorney General provided on behalf of DPS does consist of the record to be examined here, because that is the record and the information that DPS relied upon in making their decision. So they acted in the quasi-judicial function, if you will, by looking at the evidence provided by the city through those emails, and also the emails show the decision-making process, if you will, that went from the person who did the audit to the people at DPS to make the final decision. So yes, I would ask that you look at those records because I consider that to be the record here today.
If I can follow up just to make it crystal clear, you're not making any due process argument that you're entitled, that a hearing should have happened or was required in this case.
That's correct. I'm not making any argument that there should have been an actual hearing or administrative proceeding. So in the decision here, as I stated before, that DPS determined that Ms. Davis accessed her own record without a lawful business purpose. And there was no mention of whether she acted willfully as required by the statute. And in fact, in the decision, there's a recitation of what the law requires. And DPS, although it essentially quotes verbatim from Minnesota Statute 171.12 subdivision 1A, but omits the word willfully, which again shows there was no consideration of the word of whether Ms. Davis acted willfully to deserve such severe sanctions imposed here.
It's essentially well, if I can interrupt for a second, just to sure. I want to make sure I'm clear on your argument. So your focus is on whether the conduct was willful for purposes of paragraph B that's at issue here. You're not arguing in the alternative that if the record supports a determination that it was willful, that the access did not violate state or federal law.
I'm actually making both arguments, Your Honor.
Where in your brief can I find that second argument?
I'm understanding your question correctly. And in my brief, I raised the issues of whether how to interpret the statute that willful is required, and also that the decision here was based upon an error of legal theory, arbitrary and capricious, and not supported by substantial evidence. And I think that the argument regarding that the decision is not supported by substantial evidence, even as set forth on the record, is set forth in both my brief and my reply brief in the final sections.
So just focusing back on the language of the statute, and maybe help me out here because I think I'm missing something in terms of your response, but the first sentence says the commissioner, and I'm looking to the side because I'm looking at the other screen
that has
the statute up. The commissioner must immediately and permanently revoke the authorization of any individual who willfully entered, updated, accessed, shared, or disseminated data in violation of state or federal law. So it seems to me there's kind of two parts to that. In order for a revocation to happen, there have to be kind of two separate findings. One, that an individual willfully accessed, well, maybe not separate. Anyway, there's the willful piece, and then there's the piece that what that conduct was done in violation of state or federal law. And so I guess what I was trying to get at with my question, which I didn't articulate very well, is the second piece, whether the access here was done in violation of state or federal law. I didn't read your brief to argue that the access here was not in violation of state or federal law.
Perhaps I misunderstood your question then, Your Honor. And the arguments and issues that I've raised here today is one, what does willfully mean in the statute? I think that's the first question that this court needs to answer, which there's no case law yet that I could find about this particular statute and due to its newness. And second, to answer your question, the city's argument here is that based upon the record that DPS had, there is no substantial evidence to support a finding that Ms. Davis willfully accessed her record in violation of law. And as how we would claim that willfully should be interpreted in a statute. So to go along that, unless you have a further question about that issue.
No, go ahead, thank you.
So that gives me a segue then to proper interpretation of the statute is looking at other case law that has interpreted the term willfully, including in other sections of Chapter 171. This court has interpreted willfully to mean that there is a deliberate decision to violate it, some sort of a bad purpose. In other words, that the person knew that a certain set of conduct was wrong or in violation of some policy, rule, or law, and yet made a conscious decision, a deliberate decision to violate that. The Garrity versus Kemper Motor Sales case that DPS cited in its response brief is actually very, very on point here. it didn't deal with Chapter 171, but it did deal with whether or not a person, an attorney in that case, willfully violated a rule of civil procedure such that a particular sanction should be imposed upon that party or attorney. And in that case, the Garrity case, there was two components provided to what makes a willful violation. One, there was a knowing awareness of the duty imposed by the rules, and then two, a deliberate choice to disregard that duty in spite of the awareness. So in that case, the attorney was aware of his duty to answer in interrogatories. And he intentionally failed to answer them because he claimed he didn't have an awareness of his obligation to respond when he thought doing so would be a needless formality given the procedural status of that case. So in that case, we had the attorney, what the attorney did by not answering, that was objectively wrong for that attorney. It was an objective violation of the rule to not answer interrogatories as timely, as required by the rule. But because there was no subjective intent on behalf of the attorney to violate that rule, no violation was found to warrant the sanction imposed by that rule.
And here, I just want to talk a little bit about that argument that you're making, because the circumstances here do seem a little different to me in that the employee, yeah, repeatedly signed documents expressing an understanding of, you know, what's permitted and what's not permitted, and those documents included a prohibition against, you know, accessing your own records. So the knowledge part was there, and then the intent part would simply be actually, you know, intentionally instead of accidentally, you know, entering the information, right? So I'm having a little trouble understanding how willful would mean something different under the circumstances here.
Sure. In the Garrity case, my understanding here is, as an attorney, we all have the knowledge and awareness of what the rules require too. And in that case, I believe the attorney stated he was aware that he was obligated to answer interrogatories as required by rule. But given the procedural circumstances in that case, he thought it would be a needless formality, so it didn't do so. And therefore, the court found there was no subjective intent to violate the rule. He just disregarded them for whatever reason. I think here it's similar here, where Ms. Davis, and it says in the record, she informed the city, because the city acted on her behalf to DPS in this audit process, see that she didn't think it would be a violation to check her own record, to verify she was using the correct name format for part of her job functions and searching for these records. And she also didn't think it'd be a violation because she doesn't have anything on her driving record. Now, obviously, we can look at the policies and indicate that that was not an accurate interpretation of the policy. We can concede that for purposes of argument. But the point here is that she had no willful intention or deliberate decision to try to get around those rules or to violate those rules. And we can see in the record that DPS believed her. There's nothing in the record that indicates that they thought she was telling them a lie or trying to get out of trouble somehow. And in the record, it shows that even though they decided to revoke her access to DBS data. What a DPS also stated that they wanted to add an FAQ to users about using their own records as points of references and performing their job duties. And in fact, that has been done, as I understand it, or some sort of mechanisms put in place here to give users an affirmative warning. Hey, you're entering a name that's a lot like yours. Are you sure you want to proceed? Because that would violate policy. That was all done.
The decision letter that was sent on December 27th, 2021, doesn't that document reflect that DPS didn't accept her explanation for accessing the record after she successfully accessed the other record that she was trying to access, when it says towards the bottom of the page, the audit showed that a user accessed the following record without a lawful business purpose?
Letter does state that she violated some policy. I suppose you can make that interpretation here by determining that she accesses her own record without a lawful business purpose. But what's missing is the component of intent of the willfulness here. And because of the sanctions imposed by the statute to permanently and irreversibly revoke access to DBS data and referral to criminal prosecution, the statute should be construed narrowly and should be construed also strictly so as to not impose these sanctions upon someone who doesn't qualify under the statute.
Ms. Murrow, I am going to have to interrupt. I'm very sorry. I don't know if you can hear in the background. There's an alarm going off at the Judicial Center.
Oh, no.
So we are going to, it says we need to leave the building. So we're going to have to conclude for now, and we will be in touch with you in the next, say, 15 to 20 minutes to figure out when and how we can reconvene with the, I think you had about 2 minutes remaining. And so we'll make sure that we're just going to try and push pause and figure some things out on our end. And we'll log back in shortly. So please bear with us, and I apologize for the inconvenience and interruption.
Should we log off or stay on?
I think it's fine for you all to stay on. I think the judges and court staff will likely log off as we try to find a new spot here. Okay?
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you all. We're okay. Everybody's fine. Although there were some law clerks that just left the building without their judges, leaving us in peril. Okay. My fellow colleagues, judges, are you okay and ready to go? All right. Before you both logged on, I was explaining to Ms. Murrow that I think we should set the clock back to 4 minutes and give her 4 minutes. And I don't know if Judge Cochran, you'd like to start with the question that you had asked as these alarms were blaring, or how you would like to go. But if you'd like to start with that, I'm happy to do so.
Thank you, Judge Bryan. I think what I was trying to get at is the statute contemplates that in order for the access to be revoked, there has to be a determination that the individual willfully gained access to the data without authorization by law, that it was done. Well, anyway, sorry, I was reading the wrong sentence. I have to refocus now that we're back here. So the commissioner must revoke the authorization of an individual who willfully accessed data, and I'm skipping a few words, in violation of state or federal law. And I was wondering if the city is challenging only the lack of a determination regarding willfulness, or if the city is also arguing that the access here was not in violation of state or federal law.
I think it's a little bit more nuanced, if I may. First of all, the city is challenging the lack of any determination in the decision that the access here was in willful violation of the statute here, that the statute would authorize or allow the revocation that occurred here. So that's the first challenge. And then the second challenge is, even looking at the record here, it doesn't support a finding of revocation as set forth by statute. And I think from understanding the questions here presented here, there seems to be some clarification that I should make here regarding what how the statute should be construed in the city's position. And with the willful and the violation, we're not arguing here that Ms. Davis accidentally accessed her record. There's no contention for that. She did access her record here, and that was something that she actively did by typing in her name. But she informed the city through the audit process, and DPS never talked to Ms. Davis directly. They only learned from what Ms. Davis had to say through the city. And the city informed DPS that they believed Ms. Davis had no intention to violate policy, that she was forthcoming about this, that she was simply trying to verify the search format for the name so that she can do her job. And DPS, and the record indicates that DPS believed that by wanting to add an FAQ to users about whether they could use their own name as a point of reference in performing their job duties. So here we have, it's a matter of not imposing strict liability here. And there's where simply a violation in and of itself should not lead to revocation, the permanent and irreversible revocation that we have here. And there's a couple of cases that I cited that I think illuminate this argument. This first is the Green case, in which a person was charged for driving after suspension. And there's another statute in Chapter 171.241 that talks about, that says it's a misdemeanor to willfully violate any provision of the statute of Chapter 171. In that case, the person intentionally drove their vehicle. There's no question about that. But the person didn't, there's no evidence that the person did so knowing knowing that their license had been suspended. So that knowledge component was not met, and therefore the violation, or there was no violation of statute. And the other case that's illuminates this is the Henry AD case, in which a student was expelled for violating a no weapons policy. She had brought a knife to in her purse to school. The knife had been purposely put in her purse. She just forgot it was there. Once they did the locker searches, she remembered it was there and didn't report it to any authorities. And the court there found there was no willful violation to justify her expulsion because there was no evidence that she deliberately decided to violate the policy. I think that's similar to the circumstances here with Ms. Davis. There's no evidence, indication, or belief that she deliberately decided to violate policy by entering her search, her name for a search. And I see that I'm out of time here. So thank you again for accommodating the extra time here.
Well, I'm going to make sure that there, if there are any follow-up questions, that the other two judges on the panel have a chance to ask those. Judge Caites?
You know, I'm going to actually save my inquiry for rebuttal, assuming that Ms. Moreau does a rebuttal.
And Judge Cocker, did you have any follow-up questions about that?
Not at this time, thank you.
Okay. So, Mr. Marsalek, we'll turn to you and give your... There goes the clock, so whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Corey Marsalek. I represent Respondent Commissioner of Public Safety, asking this court to affirm the commissioner's decision to revoke Ms. Davis's access to the driver information system because she willfully accessed the data without authorization by law. We're here this morning because Ms. Davis signed an agreement that prohibited her from accessing her own records. She accessed her own records anyway, and she did so intentionally. Now, what I heard topside was Ms. Appellant's argument that she didn't intend to violate the records because she had a different purpose. But what my understanding is that her motive was, what Appellant's arguing is that her motive was not to violate the law, but motive is not an element of intention. In INRI AD, the question is whether or not they made the deliberate choice and they were aware of the duty. There's no question that Ms. Davis was aware of her duty because she signed multiple acknowledgments that where she acknowledged that she would not access her own data, and then she intentionally accessed her own data, as the record reflects. She
Mr. Marsalek, could you explain to me how what occurred violated state or federal law, regardless of the agreement that was signed by the employee? What was the violation?
The violation was the violation of 18 U.S.C. 2721A1, which prohibits a person from, it prohibits a contractor of a Department of Motor Vehicles from accessing the data of any individual or disclosing, knowingly disclosing or making available to any individual or entity the data of any, what's the exact terminology here? The data about any individual obtained by the department in connection of a motor vehicle record. So when she obtained the personal information that's on her driving record, which would include her name, her address, her driver's license number, that personal information is prohibited from being knowingly disclosed or made available to any person under 2721A1. And that statute is also incorporated under state law under 171.112 subdivision 7. So the data is as classified under 2721 is classified the same way under state law. So when she did that, that was the violation of state and federal law.
Counsel, though, there are certain permissible uses under that there, federal law.
There are, Your Honor, and, but none of, oh, I apologize.
And I don't see any explanation in the letter. Well, let me step back. Did any of the documents that that Ms. Davis signed include the specific language of the federal law that you're arguing applies here?
I don't think the documents incorporate mention that exact word by word language, but it does incorporate those sections. It does talk at the outset, if I can pull up the records access agreement. So on page 2 of the record, it talks about the authority for the agreement, the statements that are contained in the agreement. And under that authority, it mentions 18 U.S.C. 2721 et sec, and then Minnesota Chapter 13, Minnesota Statute 171112. So those are the legal authorities that are incorporated in that agreement that Ms. Davis signed.
Can any individual access their own records? Can they go to somewhere to determine what their driving record? Can I do that? Can you do that without violating the law?
There are ways that can be done without violating the law. I believe that, I mean, if you ask somebody at DVS for your records, they have a process for doing that. I know under state and federal law, there are ways to access the data. So I know as the exceptions that Judge Cochran noted, there is exception 13, which allows the data to be accessed so long as there's written authorization from the requester. Now, it's a separate question whether or not a person can give themselves, can request themselves to access data. I know the statement that Ms. Davis signed says that any request to access your own data or your family or friends' data has to be forwarded to a supervisor. So DVS does not allow you to access your own data, even if you provide a request. But again, that's not an issue in this case. But to answer your question, there are ways in which a person can get access to their own data under state and federal law.
Does the actual law, not the letter or the statement that kind of summarizes the rule, but does the actual law prohibit an individual from accessing their own information?
Yes, because it says that it's the data of any individual that cannot be disclosed to any person or entity. Any is a very broad term. It does not admit of any exceptions.
What about disclose, though? I mean, the word disclose, I think, suggests providing it to someone. And if it's your own data, arguably, you're not disclosing it to anyone, right?
No, Your Honor, because I think along with the information contained itself, the statute is also concerned with the source of the information. So I know under state law, if you look at the KSPTV versus Metro Transit case for the Minnesota Data Practices Act, Justice Strauss discussed the idea of how the data was contained made a difference to whether or not it was not public or public data. So it's the source of the data is also important along with the data itself. So the fact that Ms. Davis presumably knows her own address, the fact that she got it in connection with a motor vehicle record protects it regardless of whether or not she knew it outside of that. If that makes sense.
I would just like to ask a question about the letter that was ultimately provided containing the decision of the DPS. And my recollection of that letter is that it advised that the information had been access for a non-business purpose. Is that the same as in violation of state and federal law? And if not, how does that advisory satisfy the statutory requirements?
It does advise that it was in violation of state or federal law because one of the exceptions that Judge Cochran noted is an exception for records that are done with a full business purpose in the regular course of business. And my understanding is DVS uses that as a catch-all because that's the broadest exception. So, if, any of the other exceptions that are more narrow than that exception are encompassed within that one. That's my understanding of why they use that language. But directly answer your question, yes, that language directly tracks the statute under 2721 B3, I believe. It's B2 or B3. So that's the source of that language to show that it was done in violation of state or federal law.
What is just following up on Judge Gaitis's question, if I may, how does the letter or does the letter include any language that goes to the requirement that the revocation can only occur in a situation where an individual has willfully entered, accessed, shared, or disseminated data in violation of state or federal law?
Yes, Your Honor. As you noted during appellant's time, the lawful business purpose language is the language that incorporates the willfulness requirement, because as reflected in the record, BVS asked the city why Ms. Davis engaged in this inquiry, and when it determined that she had done so willfully without authorization by law, it had then came to the conclusion that it was done without a lawful business purpose. The word purpose incorporates the idea that it was done willfully, because it was done without the purpose to without a lawful purpose.
So, Mr. Marshall, look, one of the ways you could frame this is in terms of subjective versus objective knowledge, and whether that was a deliberate decision. But if somebody believes, they have a subjective belief that what they are doing is lawful, can they willfully violate the statute given that exception?
Yes, because as the definition of law of willful under the court's case law, looking at INRI AD and Garrity as appellant cites, looks at, were you aware of the duty and did you make an intentional choice to engage in conduct that violated? I think INRI AD is telling in this regard, because the court determined that it was not done willfully because the student was not aware that the knife was in her bag. Because the student didn't have the knowledge that the knife was in her bag, even though she was aware of the policy, she didn't intentionally engage in conduct that violated the prohibition.
So I'm not sure that's really addressing my question, because, you know, I'm focusing on the subjective belief that what you're doing has a lawful business purpose. And let's assume that this person believes subjectively that they have a lawful business purpose. So in other words, there's an exception to the prohibition on getting information, an exception that they believe that they have met. How can you willfully violate something if you believe that you meet an exception to that prohibition? How can you willfully violate the prohibition?
If I understand Your Honor's question correctly, it's possible that if somebody subjectively believes that their duty does not include the act that does violate the statute, then it's possible that that subjective belief would not be a violation. But I think the way I would conceptualize it, if I understand Your Honor's question correctly, is if they have the subjective belief that it's not a violation, that means they're not aware of the duty in the first place. And that's where that inquiry comes in under the deliberate choice awareness of the duty prong. And in this case, there's no question that Ms. Davis was aware of her duty, because she repeatedly signed documents acknowledging that duty.
Right. Let me ask it slightly differently, which is, do any of those other cases where we're talking about willfulness, either in terms of a specific or general intent requirement, knowledge that is that you need to have, do any of those cases have something similar like this, where there's an exception and a person can believe they've satisfied an exception to this duty while being aware of the duty, also being aware of the exception? Do any of those cases apply in that sense? Do they have an exception at issue?
None of the cases that I've seen have addressed that, Your Honor. I think, you know, if they believe they satisfied an exception to the requirement, then it's possible that that would obviate the willfulness requirement, because they were not aware of the duty because they thought they satisfied an exception to it, if that makes sense. But obviously in this case, that is not an issue here, because there is no exception that appellant has identified that she thought would have made her unaware of her duty to not access her records. And there's also no question that she was aware of her duty to not access her records.
So, Mr. Marcellic, as I understand the record that everyone has agreed constitutes a record in this case, an explanation was provided that the employee thought that there was a lawful business purpose, that she was conducting the search because she'd had some trouble with an actual search that was being performed, and sort of used herself as a test case to make sure she understood how to correctly enter the information. And then on DPS's end, some questions were asked. It was pointed out that she searched her own name somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 minutes after the failed search that she'd conducted. It seems to me that there was some kind of a credibility determination that was made here. And how is that made? And how should we be assessing that on review?
Yes, Your Honor, there was a credibility determination made here, as on page 85 of the record, I believe it is, where DPS received Ms. Davis's proffered justification for the search, they articulated that proffered justification doesn't make sense in light of the fact that she had already accessed the data that she was authorized to access. And at that point, that obviated any need for her to access her own records. So they asked the city, why did she do that when the record doesn't reflect a reason for doing that? And they didn't receive any response. So DPS made a credibility determination that her responses were not credible in light of the record evidence that DPS had in front of it.
And I think, was any of that information provided in the letter advising the employee and the employer of the ultimate decision?
My understanding, it was the letter just contained the rejection of that justification by saying that it was done without a lawful business purpose. But I think there's no magic words that the agency has to use to articulate its views on credibility or its ultimate determination. And here the record reflects, oh, may I finish my statement?
Time is up, but why don't you go ahead and finish this answer and then we'll see if there are any additional questions.
Okay. So, Ninja, there's no magic words that the agency has to use. And in view of the entire record, it's clear what DPS was asking Ms. Davis and the city about. And when they memorialized that their interaction through the letter, they was very clear to all the parties what was meant when they said that it was done without a lawful business purpose.
Are there additional questions from, go ahead, Judge Cochran.
Thank you. I would like to focus on the letter itself for a minute. And kind of following up on Judge Gaitis's question, I recognize that agency decisions enjoy a presumption of correctness, and there's important reasons based on the separation of powers for that. But there is a requirement that an agency's decision be supported by substantial evidence, and there's kind of a two-pronged analysis to determine whether that standard has been met. The first prong looks at whether the agency adequately explained how it derived its conclusion. And, generally, when an agency issues a decision in a quasi-judicial matter, such as this one, the agency provides a detailed factual basis for its decision. I don't see that here. What I see is a very conclusory letter that, basically has a one-sentence explanation for the decision. The audit showed that the user accessed the following record without a lawful business purpose, but it doesn't provide any detail as to the basis for that decision, what would be a lawful business purpose, why the access here was not a lawful business purpose. There's a whole host of factual detail that's missing here. And so I'm wondering, how this, what your argument would be to suggest that this letter is sufficient to meet the first prong of the substantial evidence test.
My argument would be that it identifies the audit, it identifies the access, and it identifies the reason why that access was not lawful. So it identifies why it was done willfully, it identifies why there was no authorization by law, it identifies the process the agency used, the audit, to come to that conclusion, and it identifies the access that that was at issue.
But it doesn't explain why the agency didn't accept the the business purpose that Ms. Davis provided. It doesn't explain what would be a lawful or an unlawful business person. Is that, would you agree with that?
I think that there's, in hindsight, lawyers can always come up with better ways for it to be written. But I think in the context of this record, it identifies the pertinent information that was at issue and that the parties were aware of. And it addresses what was at issue by identifying, you know, what was at issue and that it was done without a, that the agency rejected her proffer justification by articulating that it was done without a lawful purpose.
Thank you.
And on that basis, we'd ask that this court affirm the commissioner's decision. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Marcellek. Now we'll turn to Ms. Morrell for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Here, again, we go back to the what willfulness entails. And in the case law cited in my brief and also in respondent's brief here, the AD case has been referenced here multiple times, the same with the Garrity case. And in the AD case, it does describe willful as including a knowledge component. Specifically, and this is a quote, a knowing awareness of the rule being violated, end quote. And in that case, the student had brought the knife to school, as previously mentioned, but she didn't report it upon remembering it was in her purse. They were doing locker searches for weapons. She remembered it was there and didn't report it. And despite that fact, the court found that there was no willful violation of the policy there because she didn't have a knowing awareness to violate the rule. And again, here we have an interesting situation, which there is an apparent violation of a policy or a law, however it may be, that DPS found here that Ms. Davis did by conducting a search and accessing her own record here. But what's missing here is any evidence or any even belief that she did so knowingly in violation of the rule, that she deliberately sought out to violate the rule
Ms.
of policy.
Morrow, is there an argument that what she did didn't violate law? I mean, is there an argument to be made here that she had a lawful business purpose? If she, you know, thought she was just making sure she knew how to conduct these searches?
I think the record shows that Ms. Davis believed that accessing her own record as a test search, so to speak, she believed that was to be proper. But upon talking with her her manager, the record reflects that the city indicated that you're not supposed to do that in the future, that the policy referenced by the respondent does indicate you're not to access your own records here. And I think it's illuminating that after this happened to Ms. Davis and her access was revoked, DPS, as it showed in the record, wanted to add the FAQ to warn users not to do this, even added a warning prompt if they search for a name that's similar to their own. So there could be an argument that what she did was not in violation of a policy, but in candor, I think that the record does show that there was that such behavior was not to be permitted. However, it was not certainly clear to Ms. Davis at that time, and DPS seemed to acknowledge that she was doing this for the purpose of verifying the search format and wants to discourage users from doing so in the future. Otherwise, there's no need to clarify the process if it was as abundantly clear as respondent would have this court to believe here today. And regarding any credibility determinations here, recall that only the city is the only entity that spoke directly with Ms. Davis here. All communication to DPS through the audit was through the city business manager here. And city business manager specifically informed the auditor that they believed that Ms. Davis was not intentionally trying to violate any rule. And credibility, as set forth in my reply brief here, credibility involves determination of a person's actions or words, nonverbal cues, things that can't always be determined just based on paper writing in particular. So any credibility determination, the only one in the record, is what the city provided to DPS. And there's nothing in the record to explain why DPS discarded that credibility determination provided to it. And again, going back to the lack of awareness or the what is required to show knowledge of violation of a rule or policy or law, again, refer to this court to the Garrity case, which was referred to previously in argument. And I note that in DPS's responsive brief, they did note that there was a subjectivity analysis involved here. And they attempt to distinguish the Garrity case by saying that attorney there his failure to answer interrogatories on time. And DPS asserts that that lack of awareness was based upon the attorney's understanding of the rule, and that's why there was no violation here. Well, similarly here, Ms. Davis's understanding at the time, right or wrong, was that she could do this search to test whether she was doing the correct name format. And there's no dispute that that's what she was doing here. So based on-
you are arguing then, I guess, that she was aware of the duty, the rule, the policy, was aware of an exception for lawful business purpose, subjectively believed that she was satisfying that exception, and therefore did not willfully violate. Because it sounded like at the outset of your argument in response to Judge Gaitis's question, you were not making that specific a point. That your point was more a little bit a step back about knowledge of the illegality, for lack of a better word, of your conduct. So are you or are you not arguing that she had the subjective belief she met an exception, lawful business purpose, and therefore could not have willfully violated?
I apologize for any confusion I may have caused her. I do believe the record shows that Ms. Davis did believe that what she was doing was proper. And the record does reflect that statement. So yes, to answer your question, Judge Bryan, and again, I apologize for any confusion I may have caused here, that Ms. Davis did not violate the statute such that revocation is proper, because she did not set out to violate the law, the rule. She thought she was acting properly within its confines.
And what do you mean by proper? Are you specifically saying satisfying the exception for lawful business purpose, or some other basis such as she's getting information about herself, so therefore it must be proper?
Oh, no, she was not looking. The record shows that Ms. Davis was not looking for information for herself. She was looking to verify she was doing the search format properly so she could do name searches for her job. So that was her lawful business purpose.
Other questions from the panel? Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Sorry. Ms. Moreau, is part of the problem here that the records access agreement that she signed says, and I'm quoting, "My access is restricted to only the data necessary to perform my job duties. The DVS data will not be used for any personal or non-business purposes," but it doesn't define what a business purpose is, and it doesn't specify the exceptions, you know, the permissible uses that DPS identified in its brief. Those exceptions aren't identified. So the term business purpose isn't necessarily clear in the records access agreement.
It certainly is an issue and a problem here, especially since you mentioned Judge Cochran about performing job duties, and Ms. Davis believed she was working towards her job duties. And the record shows that DPS also thought she was working, performing her job duties, which is why they added an FAQ to clarify that they're not to do this in performance of their job duties. If there are no further questions, I thank you for your time and ask that you reverse the decision of of DPS. Thank you.
All right, thank you both for your